Please be seated. Good afternoon. My notes tell me that there are some students here from New Glarus High School. If they are present, would they please stand up? Oh, very nice. And I understand you had a chance to meet with Justice Ziegler over the noon hour. Very good. You may be seated. Well, we're very pleased to have you all with us as part of our program of Court with Class. Now, the students will know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us because they've had that opportunity before they've come in. And before I call that case, you will notice there are two empty chairs up here. Justice Shirley Abraham's son usually sits next to me. She has withdrawn from participation. Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits next to Justice Kelly, also has withdrawn from participation.
And I'm feeling very lonely.
Yeah. Well, you can move over here. So we sit five today, and we will then begin Rural Mutual Insurance versus Lester. Are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
Please do. Oh, let me stop you before your timer starts. You can go up.
Thank you.
I just want to be sure that my time is and the marshal's time are consistent with what you all said that you were agreeing to. So, Attorney Weiss, you're going to have 25 minutes?
Yeah, I've got 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Yeah, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. And then Attorney Christensen, you're going to have 15 minutes, and 10 minutes to Attorney LaFlamme, and 5 minutes to Attorney Level. Correct? Okay. Very good. Well, we're all on the same page then. Please begin.
Good afternoon, members of the court, counsel. My name is Monty Weiss. I'm from Weiss Law Office. I represent Rural Mutual Insurance Company. Sitting at counsel's table is Mark Andrews, an authorized representative of Rural Mutual Company. He is a licensed attorney in the state of Wisconsin. Generally, I will try to refer to both Van Weeks and Lester's as contractors. From time to time, I may have to refer to them individually as Lester's or Van Weeks as appropriate. There are two issues before this court, whether Wisconsin Statute Section 895.447 voids the Lester contract waiver, and the second issue is whether the contract waiver is an exculpatory contract and void under Wisconsin law. Rural Mutual submits that the contract waiver is in fact void under Wisconsin law, and in particular under the statute 895.447, and is an unlawful exculpatory contract. Correspondingly, Rural Mutual would request reversal of the Court of Appeals decision and remand the case back for trial. I would like to highlight one fact first, and then I would like to start with, if it pleases the court, the statutory argument first. The one fact is that just to make sure that Jim Herman, Inc. contracted with Lester Builders to build the barn. Jim Herman, Inc. had a separate contract with Van Weeks to do some of the concrete work. Van Weeks is not a subcontractor of Lester's. Yet the lower courts concluded that the contract waiver in this separate contract between Jim Herman, Inc. and Lester's insulated Van Weeks from liability based on that contract waiver. So, with
counsel, you want to, you know, you talk about 895.447, and it says it has a concern about restricting tort claims.
Correct.
And so I assume that's what you're going to bring as a tort claim.
Correct.
Where do you get a tort claim? I only see contract claims, and under the economic loss doctrine, if you got a breach of contract for building a poor barn, you don't have a tort claim. So you have to explain. Where does a tort claim come from?
Actually do. Have a tort claim because there was other property that was damaged as a result of the barn collapse. Several cows were killed and destroyed. That was other property, which takes it out of the economic loss doctrine.
All right. So you're only then claiming for the other property, not for the $600,000 for the barn?
We are claiming for all of it. The economic loss from the – because there's other property, the economic loss doctrine no longer applies, and we are permitted to pursue our tort claims.
Okay. All right. Well, I understand your theory now. When I was reading the briefs, I was thinking, what are they doing? Okay. Go ahead.
Fair enough. So Wisconsin Statute Section 895.447 is an unambiguous 51-word statute. It says point blank, in a construction contract, any provision that seeks to limit or eliminate tort liability is void as against the public policy of this state. And that is exactly what this contract waiver does. There are two requirements under this statute in order for it to apply. One, it needs to be a construction contract, and two, the contract, there has to be a provision in that contract that seeks to limit or eliminate tort liability.
All right. How did it limit or eliminate? Didn't it just shift the liability?
No. It absolutely eliminated tort liability for Lester's if Jim Herman, Inc. had insurance. So if Jim Herman, Inc. has its own first-party insurance, the negligent tortfeasor is never going to be held to be responsible for the damages caused.
The damages are paid for, though. It's just a matter of who pays for them, which you can contract around because you've got a right to contract.
Well, you have a right to contract as limited by Wisconsin law. And the legislature has said in a construction contract, if there is a provision in a construction contract that seeks to limit or eliminate tort liability, it is void. So in other circumstances, I would agree, you can contract around things subject to Wisconsin law. In this case, you cannot.
So because it eliminated it as to one party, you're not reading that statute as eliminating it, period. Because they still are, they're still collecting. It's just a matter of who from. But you're saying it's eliminating liability as to Van Weeks.
Well, as to Lester's and, according to the trial court, Van Weeks as well. It eliminated their tort liability. They will never have to pay for anything that was covered under Jim Herman's first-party insurance, and that provision is void. It is not a shifting of responsibility. It is an elimination of their tort liability because they will never pay, provided Jim Herman has insurance.
And, counsel, is that because insurer for Herman was a property insurer, not a negligence insurer?
Try that question one more time so I get sure I've got it.
Yeah. So the barn owner, Jim Herman, insured by you, that's a property insurance policy. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
It
so
is
that
a first.
Covers,
I'm
covers
sorry. Go
loss
ahead.
To property, without regard to liability.
It is a, we'll call it a package policy. It does have first-party property coverage. You are correct. It also has other provisions in it as well.
Right.
But the reason Rural Mutual paid is because it was a first-party property claim. You are correct.
Right. Okay. So the reason that, if I understand your briefing correctly, the reason you would say that that this eliminated tort liability is because no one's been held accountable, not Lester, not Van Wyck, not their insurers, for tortious conduct, correct?
That is correct. They are not responsible for, well.
So the payment Herman received was not a consequence of a recovery based on negligence. It was a recovery based on the contract with Rural Mutual.
That is correct.
Okay.
Jim Herman, Inc. received funds from its own first-party insurer for which it paid that premium for.
And that's what distinguishes it from simply shifting tort liability to someone else.
Correct.
All right.
That is correct. So as pointed out, there are two requirements under the statute to have the statute apply. First is that it's a construction contract, and I don't think there's any dispute at all that this is a construction contract. The second is that the contract waiver seeks to limit or eliminate tort liability. And in all candor, that condition is met as well. I don't think there's any realistic argument. I understand that the contractors take an opposite view, but as Justice Kelly pointed out, the payments to Herman were not by Lester's, Van Wyck's, or their insurers. It was because of a first-party claim that was made by Rural Mutual, and they, under the contract waiver provision in the Lester's contract, was then barred from seeking indemnification, reimbursement, subrogation from Lester's and Van Wyck's.
Right, but I'm confused by what the answers then were to Justice Kelly's question. But it's based on the alleged negligence in the construction of the barn, and it includes the payment for the cattle, which is not the same as the building. So isn't it still based on negligence?
It is. Well, we have two claims. Obviously, the reckless conduct argument, which we put in there as well. It's for both. It's for the negligence and that the reckless conduct in lowering or eliminating the rebar, which was a structural element to keep this $500,000 barn up. So it's both.
It just stems from contract, it's really the claim stems from negligence.
The claim is negligence from in the way the barn was constructed, and then the reckless part of it of lowering or eliminating the rebar, which provided the structural support for the barn.
Which is the tort.
Right. These are tort claims. Correct.
So I want to make sure that the both of you are talking about the same claim. So the claim against Lester and Van Wyk is founded in tort, right? Your subrogated claim against them.
Correct.
That's what founded in tort. Jim Herman's claim against Rural Mutual, which Rural paid, was founded on contract as a consequence of a property loss.
That is correct.
Okay.
So that's clear. You're right.
You are standing in the shoes of the subrogor, right? You're the subrogee.
Correct.
Okay, and the subrogor is Herman, correct? And Herman had a contract claim that you paid for, correct?
Had a contract and tort claim because of the economic loss doctrine not applying because we have other property.
He had a contract claim. You paid in. He had a contract with Rural Mutual, and you paid him for the contract. So he has a contract claim. The case law says that when you have subrogation, the subrogee has the same nature of claim as did the subrogor. So I'm still having trouble getting you to be a tort claim rather than a contract claim.
Sure. Let me see if I can clear that up.
Okay.
Herman, Jim Herman, Inc., Rural Mutual. Jim Herman, Inc. has a loss. The barn collapses. He turns to his own insurer and says, geez, gosh, my barn collapsed. It's covered under the policy. Please pay me.
And even if he could have sued the people that constructed the barn, even if the waiver wasn't there, he only has a contract claim except for the cows.
No, he has a contract breach claim, but he also has a negligence claim or a tort claim because the economic loss doctrine, we have damage to other property. We have damage to the cows. That takes the entire claim out of the realm of contract only and allows Jim Herman to sue for tort.
To convert a contract claim for poorly constructed building into a tort?
Yes.
Well,
because
that's interesting, but right. I mean, you may be right, but
counsel,
okay.
This is at heart a statutory construction claim. So now we have set the plate, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, who's on third. Let's go back to the language of the statute and tell me why you prevail under the language of the statute. So take the statute in front of you. I want to go through the language.
Got it in front of me, and I'm ready.
Okay, so tell me, you read it or read that part which is relevant, and you assert that it's plain language. So let me hear your plain language.
The contract language, paragraph 1, says any provision to limit or eliminate tort liability as part of or in connection with any contract.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. Any provision, what does that refer to?
Any part of the contract that seeks to limit or eliminate tort liability. In this case, the premier provision is the contract waiver provision.
Okay. To limit or eliminate tort liability, which of the two are you hanging your hat on, and does it make any difference?
In all candor, it doesn't make a difference. There's really both in response to what the contractors have argued. The first is we believe it eliminates tort liability because if there is first-party insurance, which there was, the contract waiver says, Jim Herman, you can't sue us for any damages that your own insurance company paid for you. That eliminates the tort liability. Okay? If you want to take the position that this is a limitation, it says it's a conditional one. If there's insurance, you can't sue us in tort. And if there isn't, then you can. That's a limitation on tort liability.
Okay.
So it's both.
Okay, so continue. This won't take too long.
Sure.
This is a short statute. So continue giving me your plain meaning interpretation indicating your argument.
Well, sure. If we continue on, as part of or in connection with any contract, covenant, or agreement relating to the construction, and then you can go down to construction or maintenance of a building, structure, or other work related to construction is against public policy and void. Simply put, if there is a construction contract that contains a provision that limits or eliminates tort liability, it is void. In fact, the Gerdman case, which the parties have cited, although it dealt with an indemnification provision, on page 373 of the opinion, the court says section 895.49, which is what it was previously numbered as, voids agreements in construction contracts that limit or eliminate tort liability. The district court in the Wausau Paper Mills Court, Judge Crabb, concluded the same thing, although the economic loss doctrine applied in that case, so there wasn't tort liability. But what the court said is section 895.49 does not permit parties to limit or eliminate tort liability in a construction contract where tort liability would otherwise obtain. It is clear and unambiguous. No one has argued to the contrary.
In Gerdman, they found that 895 did not apply.
That is correct.
So tell me why this is distinguishable from Gerdman.
Well, Gerdman is an indemnification agreement.
Okay,
this is not an indemnification.
Why does that matter?
Well, because the court concluded in Gerdman, when it construed the statute, that the statute doesn't reach or doesn't talk or doesn't get to indemnification agreements. It doesn't relate to that. It's not covered within the scope of that. In our case, this is a contract related to construction that limits or eliminates tort liability.
Because it's a subrogation instead of indemnification.
Because the contract waiver eliminates tort liability. In Gerdman, it was an indemnification agreement as it relates to third parties. In this case, this is a claim that says it truly, the construction waiver is really a covenant not to sue. That's what it's saying. You can't sue us if you have your own insurance.
Counsel, if there are no cows that died, does 895.447 apply? And that question is, where is the tort claim? If you don't have any cows that die, do you have a tort claim?
If there is no other property.
This sounds like Judge Crabb's opinion to me if you take the cows out, frankly.
Right. Judge Crabb was, in that case, the economic loss doctrine did apply.
Right.
It said there are no tort claims that exist.
Well, what about here if you take the cows out?
If the cows were out, there was no other property, then probably, but I would have to take a closer look at that, that the economic loss doctrine could apply in that case to eliminate tort liability.
I see. Okay.
But that's not an issue that we've addressed because the other property takes this out of the economic loss.
Well, that's your claim. I mean, and you may be right. You might have, a peppercorn that got damaged, and that'd be enough to scamper the whole thing away from contract law into tort claim. I mean, you may be right. I haven't looked at that myself.
Fair enough.
So, counsel, is the reason that 895.447 does not apply to indemnification agreements that the indemnitor is still making a payment based on tort liability?
Right. In the indemnification concept, you never eliminate their liability. It's just someone steps in to pay. But that person is still responsible. If the person who was supposed to pay can't or doesn't, the other party will still have to pay. They still have their liability as to the third party.
And it's liability based in torts.
Right.
So the tort liability does not go away in an indemnification agreement. It just shifts who pays for it.
The contractors have cited the failed legislative bills as somehow that's something that should be interpreted or looked at in construing the statute. But that violates Wisconsin law. Wisconsin law is quite clear that if the statute is unambiguous, then we look to the words of the statute and we apply the words of the statute. It is the enacted law, not unenacted intent, that is binding on the public.
Would you agree that we have to read 895.447 narrowly because it impedes upon the right to contract?
No, I don't believe you do, because the rule of law that came from was Gerdman. Gerdman relied on the Wisconsin Bankers case, and two reasons. First, let me get the first reason. Gerdman was pre-Kalal. Kalal came out and said, this is going to be how we're going to look at statutes and statutory interpretation. We are going to look at the words of the statute. If they're unambiguous, we stop there. It begins and ends with the language of the statute. Gerdman had another error, and that is it relied on Wisconsin Bankers. And Wisconsin Bankers held three conditions to construe things narrowly. One, you have to have a common law right. You have to have a statute that impinges on that common law right, and you have to have an ambiguous statute.
But here there's a constitutional right, freedom of contract, so it's a little different.
We have that right of the common law right. We have the freedom to contract. We have a statute that is impinging on it. But what we do not have is an ambiguous statute. We have an unambiguous 51-word statute.
So in other words, you're saying that we don't get to the rules of construction or construing the language if the language is plain.
Correct. We start and stop at the language of the statute. And simply reading the statute is what it says. It says the contracts with which have provisions in there that limit or eliminate tort liability are simply void as against public policy of this state.
How does that statute line up against the economic loss doctrine? Maybe we've been out to lunch on that for a long time, because we sure have eliminated a lot of tort claims.
That's true. The statute is going to apply to tort liability. If there's no tort liability in the case, the statute doesn't apply. The statutes, by its terms, are limited to tort liability and only construction contracts.
Thank you.
I may have missed this, and I'm going through the briefs again, but can't do it so quickly, just sitting here. I noted that in footnote 5 of the Court of Appeals opinion, that it makes some reference to the economic loss doctrine, indicates the parties had ignored it, and so they're not addressing it. I don't recall seeing it raised as an issue. Again, I have not here on the bench had an opportunity to again go through the briefs, but at least in footnote 5 of the Court of Appeals opinion, they say it's been ignored.
Yes, that is true. So it hasn't been something that has reached this court. It stopped at the lower court. I'd like to shift briefly, given that I don't have a lot of time left, to just talk briefly about the exculpatory contract portion of the Lester's contract waiver. It is the position of Rural Mutual that the contract waiver provision constitutes an unacceptable exculpatory contract. It seeks to eliminate a party's tort liability for harm based on intentional or reckless conduct. In part, if we look at the contract waiver itself, it has all of the hallmarks of what is an void exculpatory contract. First of all, it uses the word fault. It says negligence, fault, or indemnity. This court has held that fault is a very broad term and means and encompasses intentional, reckless conduct. If you look at the contract waiver language, it says negligence, comma, fault, or indemnity. So we know that it means something more than negligence. And in this state, we don't allow exculpatory contracts to excuse reckless or intentional conduct, because we want to have society's goal of establishing an appropriate level of conduct.
Counsel,
reckless and intentional is not.
I wasn't entirely sure what to do with the exculpatory contract argument. If you're right about the effect of the contractual waiver, then doesn't that necessarily mean that it violated 895.447.2 as well? I don't know what the exculpatory contract line of cases gets you that 895.447 doesn't already get you.
There are two different bases that we argued. One was 895.447, that it's void under that provision. We also said it was void under the exculpatory contracts case
but
law.
If that contract clause does eliminate or limit tort liability, then necessarily is in contravention of the statute. So I don't know that the exculpatory contract clause doctrine gets you anything greater than that.
Right. If the contract is void under the statute, it would also be void as a voidable or void exculpatory contract,
right,
because it seeks to eliminate all liability.
Right. And is there any circumstance in which it would violate, it would be impermissibly exculpatory but not violate the statute?
I don't know how that would happen. I think either one. So as pointed out, the language of the contract waiver is overly broad and seeks to excuse Lester's conduct and the contractor's conduct for reckless and even intentional conduct. And that, under Wisconsin law, is impermissible. There are other hallmarks of an exculpatory contract, which this contract meets in terms of the heading, the language it uses, the typeface, all of those types of things that this court and other courts in this state have said are part of the indicia of what is an exculpatory contract and void under Wisconsin law. In this particular case, as we pointed out, you know, this provision, this contract waiver is found it's in a 9-page four attachment document. It's under a heading called insurance. It never alerts the people signing the contract what rights they're waiving, and then uses the offending contact language of fault. It doesn't talk about, it doesn't highlight the language. It doesn't identify the language. It simply buries it inside of the contract. And that is something that this court has held to be in violation of Wisconsin law as an exculpatory contract. I don't have anything else on this unless the court has questions, but I would reserve the additional time, if I have any left, for rebuttal.
Yeah. Can you keep track of that form? Okay, sure. That's fine.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Weiss, co-defense counsel. My name is Kevin Christensen. I have with me today here on behalf of Lester Buildings, LLC, another lawyer in my office, Patricia Stone. Together we have represented Lester throughout the entirety of these proceedings and throughout this case. I will be addressing the issue exclusively raised by the petitioner as it relates to the public policy arguments that Mr. Weiss just concluded with, as brief, and specifically the issues of the alleged exculpatory nature of this waiver of subrogation provision. In conjunction with that, I will also address the question of whether, if this is, and we do not believe it to be so, but if this is in fact an exculpatory provision, whether or not it is permissibly so under the laws that Mr. Weiss believes they would fall.
So will you be addressing 895-447?
I will not, Your Honor.
Who will do that?
Justice, what my colleagues are going to handle that aspect of the argument.
Okay.
In combination, the two of them. And I'm going to limit my comments to the public policy determinations.
As a threshold comment to this exculpatory argument, you've emphasized that this argument is forfeited, as I recall.
Well, the argument...
Not your argument. I'm talking about your
argument. Well, let's hope so, yeah.
The issue is forfeited.
If I forfeited my argument, I've got to reread my brief better.
To
be clear, Justice, the last point that Mr. Weiss raised on the issue of particularly and specifically whether or not this is an exculpatory contract that would be impermissible is a function of his arguments about the form in which the language is found. Those are questions that this court and our Court of Appeals have addressed in cases like the ski lift case, the horseback riding case, where there is something about, I mean, fundamentally, as this court said in 1982 in Merton, that really it's a question of fairness when we get to public policy and its application to whether to render an otherwise exculpatory contract impermissibly exculpatory. Not all exculpatory contracts have been held as such. That aspect of the petitioner's argument was not part of the petition to this court. Rather, the sole argument that was raised in furtherance of this notion that public policy should step in and void this waiver of subrogation clause was solely the issue as to whether or not reckless conduct would be forgiven by this provision. I am more than ready to address the questions regarding the form of the contract in which the provision is found. But to answer your question, to the extent there's been a forfeiture, that's what it would relate to, the last comments Mr. Weiss made in furtherance of the public policy problem. But I think we can start hopefully some undisputed issues. Number one, waiver of subrogation clauses have been applied and upheld in Wisconsin appellate courts for many years. We, in our briefing, have provided this court with numerous cases from other jurisdictions that similarly hold them valid. I think the record is clear. Waiver of subrogation clauses are an important part of a risk allocation scheme that is routinely used in construction contracts and perhaps other types of contracts. We're here, of course, to talk about the construction industry. There has been no case cited to this court where any court, in Wisconsin or otherwise, has voided a waiver of subrogation clause based on public policy grounds, as rural insurance now asks this court to do. No case has been cited holding a waiver of subrogation clause is exculpatory in the first instance. The cases from the jurisdictions that I mentioned earlier have held as such that it is not, those waiver of subrogation clauses are not exculpatory, and I will go through why. In fact, Rural's position is there is a dearth of case law and precedent on these subjects simply because nobody else had come to that thought until Rural did in this lawsuit, and more particularly on this appeal. We believe that the reason there is no precedent in support of this position is that there is a fundamental distinction between waiver of subrogation clauses and the purpose they serve and exculpatory clauses and the purpose they serve. They are distinct. As I say, Rural's public policy grounds seeking to void the contractual agreements reached by a myriad of parties, actually, all of them, the contractors, the owner, and in fact, Rural itself. Their argument is that this is exculpatory and that it is impermissible due to the reckless conduct, alleged reckless conduct. Whereas an exculpatory contract or clause within a contract is intended to foreclose recovery by what the Merton Court referred to as a victim, from recovering for a damage. The waiver of subrogation clause does no such thing. The waiver of subrogation clause actually, and cases have that we have cited have made this point, actually assures that the victim is compensated. The waiver merely shifts the allocation of the risk of that damage to the victim's property insurance carrier. Importantly, I think it bears noting that if the victim, in this case, Herman, in that posture, if the victim alleges or endures a damage that is not covered by the property carrier, that claim exists. That claim is not subject to any waiver of subrogation claim. To the extent that Herman had uncovered damage alleged, it brought its claim. Herman joined this action, prosecuted its claim for damages, and ultimately resolve those claims. In fact, this waiver of subrogation clause goes so far as to expressly state, notwithstanding you have property insurance, and for those payments made, those claims are waived, but deductibles, recognizing, of course, that could be an expense borne by the victim, the deductibles are not waived. They are perfectly free to prosecute any claim that is not covered by that property insurance carrier. That is absolutely distinct in effect and in purpose to an exculpatory contract. Interestingly, Rural's position can be accepted, in my opinion, only if this court deems it to be victimized. To be in the posture of all of these people and entities on the losing side of the contract containing an exculpatory contract. The list of people in line for a balloon, I know in 2017 we had the balloon case, and we have ski hills, and we have horse riding, and we have in Shawano County, we had a race. We all know the cases, right?
We know them all.
And Rural wants to line up presumably not in the balloon line, but wants to line up as a victim in equal posture. And I don't think anything could be further from the truth. First and most directly, rural, through its policy language in effect with its insured Herman, specifically, expressly acquiesced in the risk allocation scheme that this contracting includes. The language of that could not be clearer. In its own policy, it explains that Herman that the carrier will not be liable for any loss if Herman did anything after the loss, essentially to impair their right to recover. However, importantly, in the same clause, it says you may waive your right of recovery in writing before a loss occurs without voiding coverage. As many of the cases we have cited and discussed point out, that is absolutely acquiescence in the entry that Herman had to this contract, including the waiver of subrogation clause.
How important is that particular clause in the contract to your argument? What if that wasn't there?
Well, I'll tell you, the Continental case, Justice, put an awful lot of importance on it. In fact, it made the point that by virtue of the acquiescence or approval, by virtue of very similar language in that case, that essentially activated the waiver of subrogation clause. The other cases I've cited made a similar point.
So without it, we would be in a different position here? Our ruling could potentially be that
it would be a significantly different case.
Okay.
It would be a significantly different case. Every point I am raising about public policy, absolutely based on the facts and based on this language, presupposes that rural understood and agreed. This removes them from any reasonable classification as a victim. There's another case that I think bears noting on that level, too. It's the Thomas Mason case with the governmental insurance fund. There is a case where the government had language that essentially, to use my terminology, activated the waiver of subrogation clause, where the fund wanted to essentially nullify its own language by virtue of, I think it's Chapter 605, a provision in Chapter 605. The court rejected that, saying, look, your language absolutely approves and acquiesces in the entry into that contract where your rights are waived, and that language is not going to be superseded by that that statute. So I would argue it's very important. And the language was very clear. There's no question raised by anybody as to the clarity and purpose of the language that was entered into. In fact, it gives rural, again, on my theme of lack of victim, it gives rural the opportunity to make a decision, a commercial decision, as to whether or not their insureds are going to have that opportunity to waive and be paid nonetheless or not. And dollars to donuts is cases that we have cited, in at least in foreign jurisdictions, point out the obvious. It's a commercial transaction. Likely a benefit is bestowed upon them, whether it be most likely premiums. They are not, in any reasonable sense, to be considered a victim in this scenario or scheme. That, we feel, makes a clear distinction where a waiver of subrogation clause has not and should not be considered exculpatory in nature. Herman is not uncompensated. Herman has been compensated. Herman could be compensated with direct action against against my client and the other contractors, had it not been paid for by its own property carrier. So that raises the second tier, which we don't really need to get to, given it's not exculpatory, but whether it's impermissible, if it is. And I will, as my time is running short, I'll make this point. Simply put, all of the hallmarks that Mr. Weiss and Rural want to have you believe are similar to the situation here. I can't believe there is anything further from the truth. This scenario doesn't fit into any of these categories where somebody has either been duped into entry into a contract, the insurance horseback riding case with the insurance. We don't have insurance, therefore we're going to waive our rights. Doesn't fit the category at all. The idea that recklessness is going to be in some fashion that Lester or Van Wicks or anyone else would get away with reckless conduct, and that that is a basis upon which to apply public policy. Really, really misunderstands what's happening here, I feel. Sure, there are cases that make that point, and there are cases that have been cited by us that say it doesn't matter in the context of a waiver of subrogation case. We have cases that have waived gross negligence, cases that have waived willful conduct, willful wanton conduct. But the fact of the matter is, if Herman had a claim that was based upon reckless conduct, and presumably what we're talking about is something that would lead to a punitive damage award, it was free to bring that claim. Lester stood ready, if it had to defend that and would be obligated to defend it if Herman had brought the claim. The problem in Rural's argument is that it does not make a payment based upon the conduct, the nature of the conduct, whether it be reckless or otherwise. It makes a payment based on the nature of the property damage, the loss. They made a payment for property damage loss, not for reckless conduct. As Chief Justice has mentioned or questioned, whether or not you can a subrogated party can essentially obtain more rights than its subrogation payments would bear out, the fact is it can't. It doesn't buy for property damage claim a right of reckless conduct. It's the very heart of why there are no such allegations in this case of reckless conduct. There never were. Herman didn't raise them, nor did Rural. While it is referenced as a means by which to apply public policy, if the provision is exculpatory in the first instance, it has no bearing on this matter.
You argue in your brief that because of that, because there have been no allegations of reckless conduct, that a ruling by us on that issue would be an advisory opinion. Can you
Yes.
elaborate on that, please?
My point is, it's irrelevant to the determination of the application of the waiver of subrogation clause for the very reason. My time is up, but I assume
you
would like me
to answer her question.
Finish the question. Okay.
Sure.
For the very purpose of the payment is to pay the property damage claim. It's not to pay for reckless conduct, and it's not a relevant determination by any jury in order to decide if the claim had not been waived. What they would have brought is a claim for either a breach of contract or, if a tort claim is in fact allowed to proceed, for a tort claim based on negligence. They do not have nor need a claim of reckless conduct, something that would bring about damages that it never paid for, punitive damages. And so, therefore, you'd be commenting on something, frankly, that's not relevant to the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, esteemed Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Eugene LaFlamme. I'm here representing Van Wicks in this matter. I have co-counsel Michael Snyder from my office here with me as well, counsel and fellow defense counsel. I'm here today to address the statutory interpretation of 895.447. As an initial matter, I feel compelled to just briefly discuss the claim by Rural that the subrogation waiver doesn't apply to Van Wicks. The Court of Appeals recognized that that was not an issue before the appellate court. That was also not an issue before as involved in the petition. And it was raised for the first time in the reply brief as to whether Van Wicks would obtain the benefit of the subrogation waiver.
What issue was raised for the first time? I didn't hear that.
As to whether the subrogation waiver applies to Van Wicks. So whether Van Wicks can get the benefit of the subrogation waiver. That was first raised on the reply brief by Rural. So it is not really presently proper here before the court. Also, the nature of the pleadings in this case were pled at the trial court level so that Rural does not even have a direct claim against Van Wicks, and the claims against Van Wicks' insurer, West Bend, were all contingent claims. So if you look at the nature of the pleadings, all liability for Van Wicks or even Van Wicks' insurer would flow to Lester. So by virtue of that aspect in which the way the pleadings were set up, it's without question the Van Wicks would get the benefit of the subrogation waiver, even if the justices decide that the actual language of the sub-rural waiver does not apply to Van Wyks, which I would submit that it does anyways.
So, counsel, let's let's get into the statute. I apologize for making you answer for someone else's brief, but you are the one that gets to discuss all of the statutory arrangements. So at page 8 of Lester Building's brief, it says that 895.447 prohibits, the statute says that it prohibits the limiting or eliminating of tort liability. Now, Lester Building said at page 8 of their brief that the waiver provision applies, the contractual waiver provision, applies to extinguish all claims at issue in this case. So is there a difference between extinguishing tort claims on the one hand and limiting or eliminating tort liability on the other hand? Is there a distinction between those two things?
Yeah, Justice, I think there is. In eliminate or limit or eliminate tort liability, we are looking at the elimination or the limitation of the liability in and of itself. In this instance, there's not a limitation or an elimination of the tort liability. The payor is just simply shifted to the property insurer. So the tort liability itself is still there.
So did Rural make payment to Jim Herman based on a theory of tort liability?
Rural made a payment based upon their contract, okay, Jim Herman.
And that was not based on tort liability?
It was not based on tort liability,
is
correct.
Is there anybody in this case who can be presently pursued based on tort liability?
Certainly. Herman did pursue tort liability against both of our clients, Lester and Van Wyks. And they prosecuted that case through the trial court level and up through the appellate court.
But you're saying that there is no tort liability because of the waiver in the contract.
I'm sorry, could you...
Sure. So if I understand your position here today is that Lester Buildings and Van Wyks cannot be pursued for tort liability to the extent that a property insurance company paid damages.
Well, they cannot be pursued by Rural, who has, by virtue, a subrogation claim as a result of a contract.
Yeah.
So as a result of that contract, and because of the nature of the subro waiver between its insured
So that's a little downstream of the analysis. First, we have to figure out whether tort liability got extinguished by the contract in between Herman and Lester, right? That's your position.
Correct.
That that waiver in the building contract extinguished tort liability. Yeah?
No, it does not extinguish tort liability. It simply shifts the payor for that liability.
Right. But what I'm trying to do here is I want to trace tort liability to someone who paid based on tort liability. Right.
Okay.
So Herman says either Van Wyks or Lester, one or the other of you, acted tortiously. I don't know if that's true or not. That's not before us. Right. But he says one of you two did. And you're saying you can't come after us because you got paid by your insurance company. So what I want to do is tell me who can pursue Van Wyks and Lester for their tort liability in this case.
Herman can. And Herman did.
Okay. And for the entirety of its loss without respect to the payments from Rural?
Certainly, Herman was made whole in this process.
No. Without respect to the payment from Rural, because then we're just dealing with subrogation, right? So what I want to figure out first is, let's say Herman had not been paid by Rural, right? And you would say, yeah, you can come after us for the entire amount because there's been no insurance payments, so your damage has not been, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now you say, however, let's bring in Rural now. Based on a first-party property insurance payment, some of your damages have been paid for. Now, Herman, you can't come after us for any damages above and beyond what you were paid. You can't come after us for damages that were paid to you by Rural, correct?
Sure.
Okay. Is anyone able to pursue Lester or Van Wyks for tort liability to the amount paid by Rural to Harmon.
So, Justice, and with respect, I think what you may be confusing to a certain extent is liability and damages.
No, that's not what
liability.
I don't want you to spend your time on that.
Okay.
I understand the difference between liability.
Certainly.
And
my apologies.
I'm not sure you do. Okay?
Okay.
So I understand that Rural got paid for damages. I understand that. Right. The question is whether anybody has been held liable in tort.
Yes. Both Lester and Harmon were sued, or Lester and Van Wyks were sued by Harmon in tort.
Yes.
Did they lose?
I'm sorry?
Did they lose?
No. Harmon, that case was settled.
All right. That probably isn't going to help the argument you're making.
Harmon did appeal to the Court of Appeals, and then at that point it was settled between Lester, Van Wyks, and Harmon. Harmon did not pursue.
Let's say there were a total of $800,000. I'm just going to pick a number. $800,000 in damages. He gets paid $600,000 by Rural. How much can he pursue Van Wyks and Lester for?
So if he gets paid $600,000 and he has an $800,000 claim, he can pursue, with the subrogation waiver, $200,000.
Okay. Now, if nobody can pursue Lester and Van Wyks for the $600,000, doesn't that mean that tort liability has been reduced, limited, by $600,000?
No, they can certainly still be liable under tort. So if this were to go to a verdict, you would have an apportionment for the tort liability. That apportionment would not change one bit, regardless as to whether there was the subrogation waiver or not. So it is not limiting or eliminating the tort liability. What the contract is doing is shifting the shifting the payor for those damages. So there is a difference between liability and damages within the context of the subrogation waiver, because the subrogation waiver applies only if Rural pays under their property damage policy. And in this case, and what the courts have held, that when there is a common law right that has been abrogated by a statute, and in this case, if you take Rural's position, 895.447 does abrogate a common law right, that statute needs to leave no doubt. And that's what Fussgruber tells us. The fact that we are here today is evidence that it leaves a lot of doubt. And Rural cites to the...
it always bothers me when we have a statutory interpretation case and we're not looking at the words of the statute. So let's look at the words of the statute. Huh? And I'll tell you, you got to push back or tell me why I'm wrong. I look at the statute, and it says any provision, and of course that'll be the provision we're dealing with here, right, in the contract, to limit or eliminate tort liability as part of a construction contract, now I'm paraphrasing, is against public policy and void. And I wrote to myself, the provision does just that. It limits tort liability on the part of Lester and Van Wyks. Now, tell me why that's wrong.
Well, it doesn't limit the liability because...
You're saying it just shifts it.
Correct. And because if this case were to be tried, the liability apportionment section would be the same on the jury verdict form, with or without a subrogation waiver. So that liability is still there. This is not a situation where the contract calls for a waiver of negligence or a waiver of a specific tort. Those are the type of provisions that this statute would bar. And that's not what we have in this case. And if we look at the Girdman case...
What does the word liability mean?
Well, liability certainly means the apportionment or the percentage of liability that somebody is assessed for their wrongful acts.
How does that compare with the phrase is liable for? If you have liability, does that mean you are liable for?
Well, liability can then be taken to apportion the damages that are to be paid, but it is the damages that are then paid as a result of the liability. So it is the damages that are the potential collectible damages or the potential damages at issue in a case that has a subrogation waiver that would be the difference. The liability itself remains the same.
Are you suggesting that in in my interpretation, that I am inserting, and it's okay to suggest this, that I am inserting into the statutory text limiting tort liability for damages, the words for damages. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm suggesting that limit or eliminate tort liability only goes toward the tort claims, not the damages that may be recovered. It goes to the tort claims itself, because that is where the liability flows from, is from the claims. The damages are really a separate issue. And in this case, when we look at Girdman, which says you need to interpret this statute narrowly and placing the least possible restriction on the common law right, we need to place the least possible restriction on this. And the least possible restriction does not apply to subrogation waivers. In fact, subrogation waivers, the term subrogation is not used at all in this statute. And we know that in looking at the legislative history that in 2009, there was a bill that was proposed to specifically include a waiver of subrogation. And it would have read any waiver of subrogation clause. I'm sorry, I'm close to being up. Or I am up.
You can finish your thought.
Okay.
You need
and it says any waiver of subrogation clause that is part of or in connection with a construction contract is against public policy and void. And that is the type of language that would leave no doubt if this was to indeed abrogate the common law right to contract.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Jeff Level. It's my honor to be here today representing West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. I have a scant 5 minutes, so I'm going to get right down to business. My intent is to focus on the primacy of the right of private contracting, which I heard referenced in some questions earlier
today. Before you do that, can I interrupt right away? I just want to clarify what co-counsel, if you will, was arguing to make sure that it's clear, and I think a simpler way of saying it is that Lester or Van Wyks could be found 100% liable, right? But given the contract subrogation waiver, Lester would still only pay $200,000 because Rule paid $600,000. But the fact that Lester or Van Wyks or some combination thereof would only pay $200,000 under that scenario of $800,000 in actual damages does not impact the liability determination. Is that the gist of the argument?
I think that's the gist of one of the arguments. I have a couple of others, but I agree with that. And that is to say one can be liable but not be the payor. So in the indemnification agreement example, Girdman, a party may be liable but they're not the payor. The indemnitor.
So it doesn't talk about liability for damages. What the statute is referencing is liability or fault, if you will.
Correct. A comparison question answer in a verdict form. And one of the second arguments that I was sort of hinting at.
Let me just follow up on that for a second. So in the indemnification context, the liability is not reduced or eliminated. It's just a different person paying based on tort liability, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't track the preface, perhaps, to the question.
So in an indemnification agreement, one party promises to pay for another party's tort liability, right?
Generally, but yeah, let's assume that example. That's Girdman.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Girdman says that 895.447 does not apply to those kinds of agreements because in that context, responsibility for the tort liability just shifts to someone else who has agreed to pay based on tort liability, right?
Well, responsibility, the payer's obligation.
Right, and the payer said, if you are found liable in torts, I will pay that, right?
In my experience, most indemnification agreements aren't that blunt, but they say, we'll defend and indemnify you.
I could get a form out and we could construe it and all that, but that would come down to that, right? You're found liable, I will pay for that. That's the essence of an indemnification agreement, right?
One example, yes.
Okay. So in that case, somebody pays 100% of tort liability. Here, that does not appear to be the case. So you pursue Lester and Van Wyks for $800,000, and only $200,000 of that is paid based in tort liability. The other $600,000 is paid based on a first-party property insurance contract that has nothing to do whatsoever with liability, with tort liability, right?
Well, the statute doesn't make reference to whether one's paying it as a first-party loss or as a third-party liability claim. So I'm not, I guess, again, I'm not correct.
So the statute says that you cannot eliminate or limit tort liability. Yeah? Can't do either one of those.
Right.
Okay. So if a claim is reduced from $800,000 to $200,000 because someone else is paid based on some factor other than tort liability, then the tort liability has been reduced by $600,000, hasn't it?
I don't necessarily agree, and here's why. Before this liability ever attaches, the parties got together and they reached a contract. And this is the Thomas Mason case. They've said, we're going to assess who's going to be the payor of any judgment that results. And so there isn't even any liability at that point in time to assign. Before liability happens, the parties have agreed as to what's going to happen. They've hashed it up.
Well, right. But 895.447 requires us to ask whether they could have that particular agreement in this case, right? This is not a question of it being voidable. It's a question of if it matches the terms of the statute, it's void. It's as if it never happened. Correct?
The statute talks in terms of liability. And as the Gerben Court had held, if the parties get together and assign who's going to be the payor of the liability, the statute's not offended.
Correct. On tort liability, though, right? The statute speaks to tort liability. It doesn't say contract liability. So Rural was liable to Herman in contract for $600,000. But Herman had a claim against Lester and Van Wyks for $800,000. And Lester and Van Wyks are saying, you can't do that. You can only come after us for $200,000 because we've limited our liability based on the amount that some third party has paid you on something other than tort liability.
No, I disagree with you. It's not Lester or Van Wyks saying we limited our liability. It's Lester and Van Wyks saying you, Herman, and you, Rural, by virtue of the contract choice you made, chose to waive that. So, for example,
that's secondary to the question of whether the statute eliminates the waiver in the construction contract between Herman and Lester Buildings.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah. So the question of the contractual provisions between Herman and Rural Mutual are downstream of the question of whether 895.447 prohibits the provision in the contract between Herman and Lester Buildings that would eliminate that tort liability.
I disagree with that. The policy was reached between Rural and Herman, and at the very get-go, the policy, the contract they chose said, from Rural to Herman, we invite you to waive whatever claim you may have.
Okay.
And Herman did that.
Yeah, and so Herman does that. And now our question is, was Herman allowed to do that by law?
And absolutely.
And so our question is what Herman did contrary to 895.447? And if it is, it just goes away, doesn't it?
No, I disagree vehemently, because the two parties consciously chose, Herman and Rural, consciously chose to waive whatever claim may come to exist down the road. The liability at that point is not even asserted by anyone. The parties, Herman and Rural, have said, we're not going to make that claim. You can waive it. That's what Rural said to Herman. And Herman said to Lester, neither of us are going to make that claim against either one or against any of our other contractors. And the Thomas Mason case said, that can be done. In Thomas Mason, at issue was a local government property insurance fund statute that said the fund, the local government insurer, is not bound by several waivers. And the court said, indeed, you waive the statute when you invited a several waiver.
So you can contractually waive a statutory provision that says this type of agreement is void.
Absolutely. Just like you can waive a statute of limitations, or you can waive an affirmative defense, or you can waive any number of tools you might have in litigation.
I think I understand your position.
Thank okay. You. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your attention.
Okay, I'd like you to start really where opposing counsel left off, okay? What about the waiver of the statute? Is that possible to do, like you would waive a statute of limitations?
Thank you. That was actually the first point I was going to attack, and the answer is no, absolutely not. You cannot do that.
Why not?
The statute says very clearly it is void as against public policy. The courts in this state have said that the freedom to contract is broad, but it is hemmed in by Wisconsin law. Wisconsin law will set the contours of what the parties can do. And contracts, even Merton versus Nathan, the case we cited, said, of course parties can contract as long as it doesn't contravene public policy. And the public policy in this state is contracts, construction contracts that limit or eliminate tort liability are void. So no, you cannot waive that. And to speak to the argument of the analysis that you're trying to get to, the simple answer is, could Rural Mutual sue and collect against Lester's or Van Weeks for the $600,000? The answer is no. In this case, because of the contract waiver. The contract waiver says we're not going to, it's a covenant not to sue. The agreement is between Herman and Lester, and they said, the contract says, Herman, if you have your own insurance, you don't get to sue us.
But only to the extent that the insurance company pays. So if there's something above that, they could recover that. It doesn't eliminate the liability. It just limits the damages that a party can recover because it had another source to recover those damages. Isn't that right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Okay. In one level, yes. The contract waiver language says anything that's not covered by insurance, Herman, you can sue. Okay? That part is correct. But as the Court of Appeals noted in the paragraph 3 of its opinion, there are other damage limitations and damage waivers, which Lester said, we're not going to pay for these types of damages either. For example, lost profits, lost sales, incidental or consequential damages.
And that all goes to damages. It does not go to liability, right?
Right. That the damage limitation says in that contract does talk about damages that you can't recover. That is true.
But right. Also the subrogation waiver goes to damages only, too. It doesn't speak to liability.
No, the damage waiver does. The contract, Lester's contract language does. It talks about you can't sue us for anything that's covered under your own policy. It says...
It says both parties waive all rights. I'm going to eliminate some language here. For recovery of any damages to the extent covered by property insurance, that's the gist of what we're talking about here, right? It just goes to damages. I'm not seeing the liability waiver.
Well, if you continue on a little bit farther, it talks about, I have it here, it talks about this waiver shall be effective notwithstanding allegations of fault, negligence or indemnity obligation of any party. It speaks to both liability and it speaks to damages. It is all encompassing.
But I think it's saying, the way I'm reading it, is that the waiver applies regardless of the theory of liability. But when you break it down and take out extraneous words, both parties are waiving rights for recovery of any damages to the extent covered by property insurance.
Right. That's the first part of it. But the whole paragraph, as read together, adds in the second part, which says, regardless of allegations of fault, negligence, or indemnity. It's broad enough. It is overly broad because it includes the allegations of negligence, of tort liability, of fault, which this Court has said fault means reckless conduct and intentional conduct.
But is that saying anything different than regardless of the theory of liability, this damages recovery is going to be limited.
It's saying regardless of any type of claim that you have, regardless of tort, fault, indemnity obligations, whatever it is, you can't bring a suit against us.
But it doesn't say you can't bring suit. It says you're waiving rights for recovery of damages only to the extent covered by property insurance. You can still make the claim. So if your deductible isn't covered, or under our example, our hypothetical, if the damages are $800,000 and Rule paid $600,000, you can still go after, Herman can still go after, are you sitting in the shoes, standing in the shoes of Herman? You can still go after that $200,000. It's just you've already been paid the $600,000.
Herman can go after the $200,000 because it wasn't paid by Rural Mutual. Rural Mutual cannot because of this all-encompassing language. That's the point, is that the Herman can collect the stuff that's not covered under his policy, but anything that's paid by Rural Mutual was dismissed by the circuit court on summary judgment, citing the contract waiver language, saying this contract language bars Rural Mutual's claims.
But isn't that what happens under a waiver of subrogation?
Right. In a
it's in your contract.
It seems like you're almost conflating the two. The point is that the Lester's contract waiver is too broad. Okay, if it was compliant with the law, subrogation waivers in general are valid. I agree. No doubt they are. But this is more than a subrogation waiver. The Lester's contract waiver is much broader. It includes much more, and it says essentially you cannot bring a claim against us. That's the portion that runs afoul of 895.447. It is the combination of the two.
So, counsel, let me go back to the contractual provision. It says both parties waive all rights against each other and blah, blah, blah. Right? So is there a difference between a right to a recovery and tort liability? Is there a difference between those two things?
There isn't, in my opinion, that it is the same thing. Liability without damages, it's tort liability. It's both. It's liability and the damages. That's what the statute is designed to prohibit in a construction contract. I'm out of time.
You are. Thank you. This is a really interesting case, and it's very hard when we have three of you over there because you all have a little different take. I don't know if you help yourself or not, but it's hard for us to try to figure out who to get after for what issue. But thank you very much. I think you all did a good job, and it's a very, very interesting case that we haven't had before. We are now going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:15.